Welcome to the Nation Magazine Podcasts. You're listening to Nation Conversations, exclusive audio of Nation forums, events, seminars, and salons.
I'm Betsy Reed, executive editor of The Nation, and I'm here with Christian Parenti, who is a contributing editor at the magazine, a frequent writer for us about war and climate change, and the author of a new book just out from Nation Books called Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change in the New Geography of Violence. What we're going to talk about, we're going to start off talking about is a piece that we've published this week about Christian's recent trip to Pakistan, which is still reeling from the impact of the massive floods of about a year ago, which displaced some or affected some 20 million people, as you write in the piece, many of whom are still suffering the effects of the flood and have become climate refugees. Can you tell us a little bit about their plight and what it, you know, represents in terms of what we're facing in this latest wave of climate change? Mm-hmm.
The floods in Pakistan revealed underlying problems. This became apparent to me when I was in these refugee camps, where these internally displaced camps, where there were people who had been driven off their land by the water, but now, after almost a year of living in tents, living on handouts from international aid organizations, they didn't want to go back to the land, even though the aid organizations were cutting off their supplies. The police, in some cases, were attacking them when they protested, demanding the right to stay. And what they said was, you know, that their life on the land was so miserable. They were in debt to landlords, who in some cases had private jails, who treated the indebted peasants as so much property, as a piece of the land, and treated them like animals. And so the crisis of the flood revealed this underlying problem with Pakistani society, which in many cases has made the suffering due to the flood that much worse. The inequality, the poverty, has made the effects of the flood that much worse. And it's now set Pakistan up with a new set of political problems that are potentially very destabilizing.
Just to sort of crystallize the point, I find it, you know, really striking. And usually you think of refugees as people who are desperate to return to their homes. But what you write about in this piece are all of these people who are refusing, actually, to go back to the lives they used to lead.
Yeah. Well, one guy in one of these camps, several people actually said, you know, we'll die before we go back to those landlords. To go back to the land was to go back to the landlords, and they would fall into debt. The peasants would fall into debt if they go back to the land. And a lot of them were in debt, and their debts, the interest on their debts, have been running during this year that they've been displaced. And this happens because the landlords who own the land then basically lend the peasants money, sell them seed. So they're trapped in this cycle of debt peonage.
And now the landlords are trying to force them, in fact, to go back to the land, because the landlords are in pretty desperate straits themselves in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they desperately want their peasants to go back. And so they've been showing up at camps with their armed guards. And the peasants are organizing, demanding the right to stay. The cops sometimes intervene. So where I was in Sindh in the south, the people are Sufis, and they're pretty mellow and tolerant in their religious views. Just a bit north, the next state north, in the Punjab, there's actually Taliban organizing. So you can imagine how this kind of shock, the floods, which was preceded by a very bad drought, about 10 years of drought, how this can feed into various types of violence.
So this is what you write about in your book as the new geography of violence.
Right. In Tropic of Chaos, which is based in many, you know, on these years of reporting from other places that I've done for The Nation primarily.
Africa, Latin America.
The Middle East, Central Asia. I look at the way that climate change is an exacerbating, contributing factor to violent situations. Sometimes it's quite direct, the causal role of climate change, and sometimes it's indirect. I open the book with an example that's quite direct. In northwest Kenya, there's a Turkana pastoralist named Ekuru Larman lying dead at my feet. He's been killed the day before in a cattle raid. What caused that cattle raid was, in large part, climate change. The Horn of Africa is in the worst drought in 60 years. It drags on and on. It's only punctuated by intense and extreme flooding, which really doesn't help the problem. So the pastoralists lose their herds. Their herds become sick. There isn't enough water. There isn't enough grazing for them. As the herds diminish, the young men go to replenish the herds by stealing from their neighbors. And so there's an increase in this raiding. The raiding is always, it's a traditional and standard feature of the culture in this area, but it's become more intense because of the drought, which, if not directly caused by climate change, certainly fits the pattern that scientists have predicted we can expect from climate change.
Okay, so if the effects of climate change are filtered through all these other social problems, what is the response then? What's the answer?
What you're getting at is adaptation and mitigation. I mean, what this book is about bad forms of adaptation. I mean, for some people, the answer is pick up a gun and go steal your neighbor's cattle. Like, that's basic adaptation, survival level adaptation.
Adaptation to this new extreme weather pattern we have around the world.
There are other examples in the book of positive adaptation. In northeast Brazil, I stayed with a group of MST farmers, the landless movements, the Movimento Sem Terra in Brazil. There's a group of farmers there who are occupying land, but also adopting agroecological forestry methods, which are designed to work with drought, to work with extreme weather, and to not rely on pesticides and fertilizers. And so that's a form of adaptation that's progressive, that's about the reconciliation between human civilization and nature. And as that example showed, it also really depends on social justice. And in the case of the MST farmers, property rights. They had two pieces of land. One they owned, where they were using these new methods. One they were occupying, which belonged to an absentee Italian rancher. On that piece of land, they weren't using these farming techniques, because it was too labor-intensive and it was too much risk for them to invest their lives in this piece of land that could be taken away from them. And to me, that indicated how, without redistribution of wealth and land and opportunity to the poor in the global south, it's going to be very hard for there to be a kind of technical adaptation of new, complicated experimental methods for surviving in difficult climates. So we've got these two choices, and unfortunately, even in a progressive place like Brazil, the agroecological forestry and land redistribution to the poor are not, they're getting some attention, but they're not really at the center of the policy agenda in the way that they should be, and that's really what needs to happen.
Let alone in the U.S., where you talk about the politics of the armed lifeboat as a response to climate change.
Yeah. In the U.S., we see, you know, the Pentagon, which doesn't make policy so much as implement it. It is one of the few parts of the government that really takes climate change seriously. And they've been running these scenarios, and they see that they are going to be called upon, the armed services are going to be called upon to intervene in all sorts of ways in a world that is slipping into crisis over the next several decades. And they don't predict that there's going to be large conventional war between states over dwindling resources. They think there'll be internal warfare and social breakdown, and so they will have to be called on to perform counterinsurgency and engage in low-intensity conflict. And I think that's kind of disastrous for that to be the primary response of the United States to this gathering crisis. The other thing, you know, what we should be doing is developing ways to sort of support the types of progressive adaptation that are developing in the global south, and also taking on our responsibility as a large polluter to really mitigate the emissions from our economy, that is to say, to cut our greenhouse gas emissions. And there's a lot that could be done right now, some of which I've written about in The Nation, without having to pass new legislation, without having to appropriate new money. The federal government could allow the EPA, well, the Obama administration could allow the EPA to really regulate greenhouse gas emissions robustly and thus reduce our emissions.
Not without a political fight, though.
Not without a political fight, but they don't need new law. There are no legislative or legal hurdles in the way. They just have to suffer the consequences of bad stories being told about them in the media, and they need to push back, and they need to tell other stories, but actually, which I think is completely doable. And I think that they're dragging their feet on empowering the EPA to have really aggressive, robust point source review there's no excuse for it. The other thing the Obama administration could be really robust on is using the big green buy, the power of federal purchasing to help build economies of scale for clean technology like wind power, solar power, electric cars. As I outline in the end of the book and have discussed in articles for The Nation, the federal government and state government spending in the U.S. is about a third of GDP. The federal government is going to, the federal government has the largest fleet of buildings in the country, largest fleet of vehicles in the country, single largest energy user in the economy. It's going to spend money on electricity no matter what. It might as well spend that money on power from solar and wind sources, which would be good in and of itself directly because it would reduce emissions, but it would also help build economies of scale and efficiencies, which would help lower the price of clean technology, such as electric cars. And once those technologies become cheap enough, then there will be widespread adaptation throughout the economy without any new legislation, without having to fight these really reactionary elements in the Congress and Senate about this stuff.
Well, people can read Christian's piece, was about a year ago, on the Big Green Buy, where he made this argument. And his most recent piece, Pakistan, 1 Year After the Floods. Also check out his book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks for having me on.
Nation Conversations is a product of The Nation magazine and is available on iTunes. You can hear more podcasts at thenation.com/audio. Thanks for listening.